kallade svarta luckan. Ett 150 mila band mitt i Atlanten där det inte gick att få flygunderstöd från kusterna. Ubåtarna kunde närma sig konvojerna i skydd av mörkret och gå till anfall. ...1942 började ubåtarna få övertaget. De hade sänkt hundratals fartyg för de allierade, och farvatten öster om Nordamerika hade blivit en slaktplats. Ubåtsflottans befälhavare, amiral Carl Dönitz, grupperade sina ubåtar i så kallade vargflockar. Den här strategin byggde helt på enigma-meddelanden. På väggen i stridsledningsbunkern hade Dönitz en stor karta med rutnät över norra Atlanten. Dag och natt sändes meddelanden som krypterades på enigma-maskiner till och från ubåtarna. Amiralen flyttade sina ubåtar som schackpjäser exakt i de allierade konvojernas spår. Flottans ledning i London arbetade dygnet runt med att styra konvojerna på omvägar kring vargflockarna. Men det var ont om underrättelsematerial. Forsörerna var tvungna att lösa tyska flottans enigma-krypto. På en lantegendom utanför London arbetade brittiska och amerikanska forsörer med att tyda det tyska överkommandots order. Deras dagliga uppgift var att lösa nyckeln, de sex bokstäverna som markerade dagens tyska rotorinställningar. En av dem var Arthur Levinson från New York.
Concentrating on one key and seeing the traffic from that operator day after day, you got to know some of his likes and dislikes, and then particularly in the selection of indicators, which was left to the individual, and certain individuals tended in certain directions. Some engaged in obscenities, which were helpful. Some were fans of American movie stars, and in one case the outside indicator was Tom, and we thought the maybe the inside Tom, but turned out it was Tom Mix, who fortunately had a six-letter name.
Två Cambridge matematiker, det excentriska geniet Alan Turing, som ofta betraktas som den moderna datorns fader, och Gordon Welchman, hade konstruerat en maskin som kunde testa de möjliga rotorinställningarna. Utrustningen bestod huvudsakligen av en stapel med 12 enigmahjul med 3 rotorer. Till slut hade britterna 60 sådana här maskiner i dygnet runt drift. Utan dem hade man inte kunnat knäcka enigma-kryptot. Man hade redan haft stora framgångar med Luftwaffes och arméns kryptomeddelanden, delvis tack vare att de tyska krypterarna valde egna nyckelord. Men inom tyska flottan var nycklarna strikt angivna i ett månatligt cirkulär. Då fick den unge forsören Harry Hinsley en idé. En flottstyrka från Scapa Flow-basen i Skottland skulle ila norrut och överfalla ett tyskt väderskepp i hopp om att erövra månadens nyckelcirkulär. Det fungerade. Man hade också turen att sjunkbomba en ubåt och tvinga upp den till ytan. En styrka ledd av den 20-årige David Baum gick ombord.
The 12-volt secondary lighting was on. The main lights, of course, had all been broken by all the depth charging, but there was a dim light. You could see enough. And it was very quiet. No generators running like you have in a ship all the time. Hum, no hum. Deathly silence. Just the hissing, a nasty hissing noise coming out of the batteries, presumably. Gas escaping. And then the rolling to and fro to Atlantic swell, the plop of the sea. By far, of course, the most important thing was the Enigma machine. And there it was, screwed to the table alongside the wireless set. And, of course, we didn't know what it was. We knew it had something to do with decoding, because it was a typewriter, looked like a typewriter. And my telegraphist, who always carry a telegraphist in an armed boarding party, he had a screwdriver, he unscrewed it, and we passed it up. And of course, the miracle was it wasn't dropped overboard.
Nu kunde britterna utläsa ubåtssignaleringen och lyckades rädda tillräckligt med tonnage för att hålla krigsmaskinen igång. Men i februari 1943 kom Dönitz med en ny Enigma med fyra rotorer som enbart skulle användas av ubåtarna. Än en gång famlade de allierades försörjare i blindo och ubåtarna kunde fortsätta att härja i konvojerna. I Storbritannien hann man inte med att bygga fler forceringsmaskiner. Men i USA hade man konstruerat över 200 stycken. De betjänades dygnet runt av speciella lottaavdelningar i flotthögkvarteret i Washington. En av lottorna var den tonåriga Ronnie Julick.
I joined a small contingent of waves that was sent to Dayton, Ohio to the National Cash Register Company. In Dayton, we were assigned to a building and sort of a laboratory. We sat at a table with these small wheels. We were given a soldering iron and many little wires of different colors and a graph to follow. And we soldered the little yellow wire here, the little green wire over here. And this went on for an 8-hour shift. When we left the building, another shift came in and proceeded to wire the rotor wheels. One day we came on duty and were told that we were going back to Washington, D.C. And when we returned to Washington, we were assigned to barracks near the Naval Communications Annex. It was on Nebraska and Massachusetts Avenue in Washington. The first day on duty, we were ushered into the chapel. And a naval officer got up in the pulpit. And I remember thinking, isn't this lovely? They're welcoming us here with a prayer, a little benediction. And this big fellow proceeded to tell us that the work we were about to do was top secret. And he said, we must never talk about what goes on at this base. He leaned over the pulpit and he said, and don't think because you are women, you will receive any special consideration. So if you talk about what goes on here, you will be shot.
Det var inga som blev det, vad man vet. De 200 testmaskinerna slammade på under resten av kriget.
Once the United States came into the naval war, cooperation became extremely close between the British codebreakers at Bletchley Park and the American naval codebreakers at Nebraska Avenue in Washington. They were not actually hardwired together in that the machines, the bombs, the key finding aids were actually linked together, but the cooperation was extremely intimate in that when one found a key or a possible key, it was immediately reported to the other side of the Atlantic so both could recover the messages based on this key.
Från mitten av 1943 bidrog uppgifterna som försörjarna levererade till att krigslyckan vände i Atlanten. Fortfarande förlorade konvojerna fartyg, men nya vapen, flygunderstöd med längre aktionsradie, radar och mindre hangarfartyg hjälpte till att utrota ubåtsplågan. Hur stor roll spelade försörjarna för segern i kriget? En stor del av deras verksamhet är fortfarande hemlig. Men det står klart att de förhindrade att slaget om Atlanten förlorades. Tills förbättrade vapen kom som möjliggjorde segern. Om försörjarna inte hade knäckt de japanska Purple eller JN-25-koderna och den tyska Enigma-maskinen kunde kriget ha fortsatt betydligt längre än det gjorde. Underrättelseflödet var krigets bäst bevarade hemlighet.
With the information available from code breaking, the Allies were able to divert their convoys around the wolf packs. They were able to win battles on land. In the Pacific, the Americans were able to defeat the Japanese at the Battle of the Midway, turning the tide of the war in the Pacific. And the war was considerably shortened by these activities, thereby saving lives and preventing many women and children from becoming widows and orphans. And in the end, code breaking became the preeminent source of intelligence, and it remains so today.
När de allierade gick in i Berlin 1945 fann de en stad i ruiner. Riksdagshuset var ett utbränt skal. De amerikanska specialtrupperna intresserade sig för den oansenliga byggnad som inrymde det japanska konsulatet. I en bunker hittades en märklig anordning som man inte kunde identifiera. Den skickades till Washington och hamnade till slut på Frank Rawlets skrivbord. Han såg direkt att det var hjärtat i en japansk purple-maskin. Än idag är det den enda delen till en japansk purple-maskin som återfunnits.
Och alla hörde förstås att det var Hans Viljus som berättade.
Den 24 juli 1944, von Stauffenbergs misslyckade attentat mot Hitler.
Stauffenberg was on his way to a top-level briefing, and this time he was determined that Hitler would not leave the meeting alive. An aristocrat by birth, Stauffenberg came from a Catholic family with a long tradition of speaking their minds. A brilliant scholar and a natural leader, he joined the army at the age of 19. A true patriot, Stauffenberg believed that public service to the state was his noble duty. He would sacrifice everything to protect the honor of sacred Germany. In 1930, at the age of 23, he married Nina von Lechenfeld and became a devoted family man. When war broke out in 1939, Stauffenberg, while not a Nazi, supported Hitler. He believed it was necessary to help the Führer win the war for Germany. As a military officer, Stauffenberg excelled and in 1940 was awarded the Iron Cross First Class. But he became increasingly appalled by the crimes of Hitler's cruel regime, the systematic atrocities against European Jews, the mass murder of Poles, Russians, and prisoners of war. He came to see Hitler as the head of an evil regime that threatened Germany and the entire world. The fool is bent on war. He's prepared to squander the flower of Germany's manhood twice in the same generation. By the summer of 1942, Stauffenberg was convinced that Hitler must be stopped at all costs. But he was not able to act immediately. His fate lay thousands of miles away in the deserts of northern Africa. He was posted to Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's elite Africa Corps. 3 months later in Tunisia, he suffered a direct hit during an aerial invasion on his division. He lost his left eye, his right forearm, and 3 fingers of his left hand. He would be in constant pain for the remainder of his life. On Stauffenberg's return to Germany, during his slow and painful recovery, he made the momentous decision to kill Hitler. Once decided, his resolve never wavered. But he was not alone. Throughout Hitler's reign of terror, among the crowds of fervent pro-Nazi Germans, there existed men and women from every level of education, background, and political persuasion who opposed Hitler and plotted his death. Nowhere more so than in the offices of the high-ranking military elite who wanted to place power back in their own hands and negotiate peace with the Allies. Stauffenberg saw the crushing defeat of Rommel's African army in 1943. Further retreats followed. By the summer of 1944, the Allies were advancing from the west through northern France and from the south through Italy. While in the east, the Russians were pushing towards the heart of Germany. Hitler seemed blind to the imminent destruction of the Third Reich. Stauffenberg knew that he must act. His sacred Germany faced utter humiliation. Stauffenberg soon emerged as the leading force behind the military opposition to Hitler. What the conspiracy lacked, however, was regular and close access to the Führer. This problem was solved in July of 1944 when Stauffenberg was appointed chief of staff to General Fromm, commander of the Home Army in Berlin. His new position gave him access to important military information and to top-level meetings with Hitler himself. Stauffenberg now had the opportunity to get close to the Führer and deliver a killing blow. Stauffenberg was guided by General Ludwig Beck, former chief of Nazi Army General Staff, who resigned in 1938 in protest at Hitler's invasion of Czechoslovakia. When Hitler's military ambitions became apparent, Beck felt a responsibility to restore justice to the German people by bringing down the Third Reich. The ever-present risk of SS informers made meetings a dangerous undertaking. Stauffenberg chose a British-designed time fuse bomb that would allow him to leave Hitler's side before the deadly explosion. The timing mechanism was ingenious. By simply pinching the neck of the fuse 10 minutes before the explosion was to happen, a glass tube would be broken, releasing acid that would eat its way through a wire, holding back a spring and a striker. Once the wire was destroyed, the striker would be released, detonating a cap that would set off the explosion. Stauffenberg now had his weapon, and on the 15th of July 1944, he was given his chance. Besides Adolf Hitler, Stauffenberg wanted the bomb to kill two of his top henchmen, Heinrich Himmler, head of the dreaded Gestapo, and Field Marshal Hermann Göring. On the 15th, Himmler and Göring were to meet with the Führer. Stauffenberg was ready. But at the last minute, both failed to attend. He abandoned the attempt. Stauffenberg now had to act quickly. The Allies were tightening the net around Hitler. There had been too many near misses, and time was running out. At home with his family, he waited. When he received orders to report to the Wolf's Lair on the 20th of July, he knew this might be his last chance. On the eve of his dangerous mission, Stauffenberg strengthened his resolve by quoting from the German poet Stefan George. The High Prince of Vermin enlarges his domain. No pleasure eludes him, no treasure or gain. Fittingly, the name of the poem was The Antichrist. And to Stauffenberg, the leader of his country was the devil himself. Next morning, Stauffenberg flew to Rastenburg in East Prussia. With his aide, Werner von Heiften, he was to present Hitler with an update on the Home Army's defense preparations for Berlin. At first, everything went according to plan. They passed through a labyrinth of checkpoints with ease. Thank you. Stauffenberg knew that the conference with Hitler was set for 1 p.m. At 12:25, the situation took a dangerous turn. Because of the unexpected arrival of the Italian dictator Mussolini, his meeting with Hitler had been moved up to 12:30. Stauffenberg must come at once. Although he risked keeping his superior officers waiting, Stauffenberg needed a few minutes alone with his aide, Heifetz, to set the fuse on the bomb. Using the excuse that he could not appear before his Führer without freshening up first, Stauffenberg was shown to a room. Stauffenberg had intended to use both bombs, but he was interrupted by the adjutant, and only one bomb was activated. He was now committed. All Heifetz could do was pray. As he walked quickly to the conference room, Stauffenberg knew that the acid was now eating through the wire inside the time fuse. The bomb should explode in 15 minutes, but he could not be certain. As Stauffenberg approached the bunker, he handed his briefcase to the adjutant and asked to be sat near to Hitler on account of his impaired hearing. When Stauffenberg entered the room, the meeting had already started. Hitler was being told the bad news. Russian troops were only 150 kilometers east of the Wolf's Lair. Stauffenberg took his place at the table and immediately realized that neither Himmler nor Göring were there. But he could not stop now. The briefcase was near Hitler and the bomb set to go off. It was time to go. He made the excuse that he had to make a vital call to Berlin for some last-minute defense information he needed for his report. He would return in a moment. Stauffenberg walked quickly towards his waiting car.
Unsere Truppen in eine Falle gelangt.
Mission accomplished. This was only the first part of Count Stauffenberg's mission. With the Führer dead, he had to get back to Berlin to lead a military coup. The Wolf's Lair went on red alert. All security was tightened. Aided as much by sheer luck as his presence of mind, Stauffenberg passed through all but the last checkpoint. There, orders had been given that no one be allowed to leave. Stauffenberg had to speak personally to the commandant's aide. He said he was pursuing the would-be assassin and needed to pass. The bluff worked. Stauffenberg had no further need for the second bomb. At 1:15 p.m., Stauffenberg and Heiften flew to Berlin. Back in Berlin, at the Home Army headquarters, Stauffenberg informed his co-conspirators that his mission had been successful. The bomb had worked. There was an explosion as though a 6-inch shell had hit the room. There is no way anyone in that room can still be alive. Hitler is dead. When Stauffenberg's superior, General Fromm, refused to believe his Führer was dead, Stauffenberg placed him under house arrest and took over his desk. With Fromm out of the way, Stauffenberg took over the reins of the coup. All afternoon and well into the night, Stauffenberg was in constant communication with senior officers and commanders throughout Germany, confirming Hitler's death. Beck and the other conspirators gathered at the War Office as Stauffenberg, with calm determination, pushed the uprising forward. He ordered radio and signal stations to be seized. Martial law was declared across Germany. In France, Vienna, and Prague, key communication positions were taken and members of the SS and Gestapo placed under arrest. Summary courts-martial were scheduled for that night. Germany was almost out of the hands of a ruthless maniac, Adolf Hitler. But not quite. Unforeseen by Stauffenberg, at 6:30 p.m. that same evening, Hitler's dreaded propaganda minister, Goebbels, authorized a broadcast announcing that an assassination attempt on Hitler had been perpetrated. The attempt had been unsuccessful. Hitler was only slightly injured and would speak publicly later. All known or suspected conspirators were named as traitors. It had taken too long to mobilize the coup. Until Stauffenberg's arrival in Berlin, the conspirators had remained inactive and undecided. Valuable time had been wasted. Once news of Hitler's miraculous survival spread, the coup quickly collapsed. SS men poured into the War Office. Stauffenberg and the other conspirators were arrested, and by midnight, the revolt had been crushed everywhere. Stauffenberg refused to believe it, but something had gone wrong at the Wolf's Lair that afternoon. When Stauffenberg was satisfied that the briefcase was lying close to Hitler, he made his excuses and left the room. But unknown to him, one of Hitler's aides moved the briefcase behind the oak table's heavy leg. When the bomb went off, Hitler was also standing up, leaning well over the table. The table saved his life. The explosion was so great that Stauffenberg thought no one could have survived. In fact, only two officers were killed. The air pressure caused by the explosion found outlets through the wooden floor, the three windows, and the airspace between the wooden building's roof and the concrete slab on top of it. It is almost certain that if Stauffenberg had taken both bombs into the room, no one would have survived. Hitler was at first elated by his survival, and on the same day he proudly showed Mussolini what he lived through. I am invincible, he cried, visiting the injured officers in hospital. But his euphoria was short-lived, and soon afterwards he became more isolated and paranoid. He never again appeared in public. And in the death camps, Hitler's persecution increased. 1 million more died in 9 months. Right up to the moment the Allied troops marched into and liberated the camps, innocent people continued to be systematically starved and tortured to death. And Germany became a bloody battlefield as the Russians continued their offensive right into the heart of Berlin and the Allies rained death on German cities. 3 million lives were lost in the fight for Berlin. Hitler ordered the arrest of all suspects connected with the attempted coup. Over 5,000 were tortured and hung by the Gestapo. At midnight on the 20th of July 1944, Stauffenberg was one of the first to die. As a junior officer, he was not given the luxury of suicide.
Anlegen. Feuer! Achtung! Anlegen! Lang lebe unser heiliges Deutschland! Feuer!
Long live our sacred Germany. What matters now is to prove to the world and for the records of history that the men of the resistance dared to take the decisive step and put their lives on the line. The last 9 months of the war saw mass destruction and the loss of over 15 million more lives. All might have been saved if only on a calm summer's day in 1944, one oak table leg had not come between a briefcase and Adolf Hitler.
Föddes på slottet Friedrichstein, en tysk-preussisk högadlig familj med 600-åriga anor i området. Många prominenta gäster, kejsare och politiker av hög rang besökte familjen Dönhoff. Men när Hitler kom till makten stod det klart för Marion Dönhoff att hennes hembygd och Tyskland gick mot sin undergång. Hon deltog i sammansvärningen mot Hitler som skulle kulminera med ett attentatsförsök den 20 juli 1944. En grupp officerare med överste Klaus von Stauffenberg som ledare skulle mörda Hitler med en sprängladdning placerad under bordet i fyrens högkvarter i Ostpreussen. En civil löst sammansatt krets förberedde statskuppen och maktövertagandet och Marion Dönhoff fanns bland dem.
Wissen Sie, das war nicht so, dass es war ja nicht eine Organisation, das muss man sich nicht vorstellen. Es war ein, im Grunde eine lebensgefährliche Sache, wo man immer auf diesem dünnen Grat zwischen Leben und Tod wandelte. Und jeder tat, was er konnte. Also ich habe versucht, weil ich ziemlich viel Sensorium habe, versucht, Leute rauszufinden, die wir brauchen konnten nachher. Und diejenigen, die man unbedingt sofort beiseite schieben musste. Wissen Sie, es hatte keinen Zweck, das vergessen die Leute immer, es hatte keinen Zweck, einfach ein Attentat zu machen. Das hätte man jederzeit machen können, den Dings umlegen. Aber damit war nichts gewonnen. Dann wäre ein Gauleiter gekommen, hätte den Bürgerkrieg entfesselt und alles wäre viel schlimmer geworden. Sondern es musste dieses riesige Netzwerk, was die hatten, die Gestapo, SS, SA, Partei, das musste man versuchen, durch ganz gezielt, ein Netzwerk konnte man ja nicht aufmachen, ganz gezielt die Führungsstellen zu besetzen mit sozusagen unseren Leuten.
Das ist der Schauplatz des verbrecherischen Anschlages, den ein kleiner Kreis gewissenloser Offiziere am 20. Juli auf den Führer und auf den Stab der Wehrmachtführung verübte. Ein gerechtes Schicksal hat das Verbrechen missglücken lassen.
Men Hitler hade tur och undkom med bara lätta skador. Sammanbiten kunde han planera en kvalfull hämnd mot attentatsmännen. Många av Marion Dönhoffs närmaste vänner greps och hängdes i slaktkrokar. Hon blev aldrig avslöjad av Gestapo. Men hon skrev senare, inget kunde vara värre, att förlora alla vänner och bli lämnad ensam kvar. Marion Dönhoff blev en av 13 miljoner tyskar som tvingades fly undan de sovjetiska trupperna. I januari 1945 lämnade hon sin hembygd och familjeegendomen och flydde till häst i sträng kyla med de sovjetiska trupperna i hälarna. Ritten tog henne 7 veckor innan hon nådde Hamburg. Hon värvades där till den nygrundade liberala tidskriften Die Zeit. Där började hon sitt andra liv. Tidningens uttalade mål var att skapa ett nytt Tyskland med demokratisk själ.
Das war natürlich wunderbar. Wir waren ein kleiner Haufen, 10 Leute vielleicht, die nur das eine Ziel hatten. Endlich sind die Verbrecher weg. Jetzt machen wir, versuchen den Bürgern wieder vernünftige Urteile beizubringen. Und das war natürlich herrlich.
Haben Sie das Ziel erreicht, den Deutschen einen demokratischen Geist zu geben?
Ja. Ich finde ja augenblicklich, gerade jetzt die Tage, es geht ja alles, ist immer eine Mode, auch in der Politik. Jetzt schreiben sie alle seit 2 Tagen, die Deutschen wären die Demokratie satt und ich weiß nicht, was ist alles Blödsinn. Sie verstehen bloß nicht genau, was Demokratie ist, aber sie wollen alle genau das, was Demokratie ist, nämlich Pluralismus, eine offene Gesellschaft, Meinung, freie Meinungs, reisen können, wohin sie wollen, lesen, was sie wollen. Das ist für den Normalbürger Demokratie.
Dönhoff kritiserade förbundskansler Konrad Adenauers starka bindning till väst och hårda attityd gentemot öststaterna under det kalla kriget. Hon var i början av 70-talet en av Willy Brandts närmaste rådgivare när det gällde att öppna en dialog med de kommunistiska staterna i öst. En vilja att försonas med sina grannar som Willy Brandt visade när han föll på knä vid monumentet för offren i Warszawas ghetto.
Das war furchtbar wichtig, weil erstens mal war es eine Geste, die noch niemand zustande gebracht hat. Kein Staatsmann, kann ich mir vorstellen, der sich da vor diesem Denkmal auf die schmutzige Erde kniet. Also das hat die Polen viel mehr beeindruckt, wie 1000 Erlasse und Konferenzen und so. Aber dieses Bild, das werden sie nie vergessen. Das war wirklich, fand ich, eine große Tat.
Aber hat nicht diesen Dialog mit dem Osten die Macht der Kommunisten nur verlängert und den Zusammenbruch des Kommunismus verzögert?
Nein, ich glaube, dass die Entspannung, wie ich eben schilderte, die Sozialisten vertreten haben, dass die dazu geführt hat, dass der Kommunismus zusammenbrach. Denn das war natürlich dieses gar nicht hingucken und da konnten sie machen, was sie wollten und den Leuten einreden. Was sie alles fertig bringen, das war tödlich.
Grevinnan Dönhoff har levt ett brokigt liv. Hon har rest mycket över hela världen. Hon har alltid gillat att köra fort i snabba bilar. Hon har fått hedersdoktorat och utmärkelse från när och fjärran. Men hon har aldrig glömt sin hembygd, trots att hon förlorade allt. Slottet brändes ner till grunden och många i familjen dog under kriget.
Alla freunde och från min familj egentligen också. Tja, aber man musste neu anfangen.
Was sagen Sie jetzt? Was wünschen Sie sich jetzt für die Zukunft?
Für Deutschland?
Oder für Sie selber?
Ach, ich selber bin mir eigentlich nicht so wichtig, muss ich sagen. Aber für Deutschland würde ich mir wünschen, dass es in ein ruhiges Fahrwasser kommt, wo sie möglichst nun nicht entweder sich nach außen gegen Vorwürfe verteidigen müssen oder innen die extrem Rechten oder die extrem Linken. Und ich bin optimistisch eigentlich. Ich denke, ich glaube, es könnte gehen.
Marion Dönhoff hat aldrig ångrat något i sitt liv.
Ich habe immer die Dinge so genommen, wie sie gekommen sind, versucht, was draus zu machen. Ich habe nie Pläne gemacht, habe alles immer dem Zufall überlassen. Und das war sehr vernünftig offenbar, denn das war immer gut gegangen.